five-major Catholic graduate of Queens College with an advanced degree from Columbia University. Sandra Short has published fiction and poetry in such journals as the Swami Review, Columbia, Commonweal, Plowshares, the Colorado Quarterly, and the South Carolina Review. She has co-authored two nationally recognized texts, The Borzoi Handbook for Writers and The Random House Guide to Writing, now in its third edition. She is the recipient of numerous awards for writing and for teaching others how to write. Named a master teacher at City University from 1981 to 85, she was presented last semester with a Golden Apple Award for distinguished teaching by honor students at Queens College. Most recently, she has received the prestigious Ingram Merrill Grant of $10,000 for work on the next novel. The Great Letter E has been compared most favorably by one reviewer in Newsday to Woody Allen's film Crime and Misdemeanors. Both deal with Jewish eye specialists whose marriages are in jeopardy and who have plenty of questions to ask of a God who may or may not exist. Woody Allen's anti-hero is murderously emptied of his integrity, and his story closes on a note of complete cynicism. In The Great Letter E, on the other hand, the philosophic Barry Glassman ends up lonely, but very much alive to the world, vulnerable, but changing. His story, which takes place in our favorite landscapes of Queens and Brooklyn, is marked by a wonderful, quirky humor and a willingness to tackle the fundamental problem of how to live our lives in the world that we've inherited. The problem is, I think, brilliantly poised by a quote, yeshiva boy lunatic, a red-cheeked, fiery 23-year-old who bases his story, or his sermon, I should say, on an Iranian proverb. If you see a blind man, kick him, lest you be kinder than God. And now Sandra Shore will introduce us to this blind man named Messenger, who may or may not be a messenger, but is certainly one of the many splendid characters in this splendid first novel.
Who some of the characters are, so that those of you who are maybe only up to letter A or B, haven't quite gotten to E, will know who I'm talking about. The narrator is a male, and you're going to have two readers, both of whom are female tonight, so we do this gender transfer, which Flaubert did all his life and others of that ilk. Barry Glassman operates an optometry shop. Can you hear me? Barry Glassman operates an optometry shop on 8th Avenue in New York, and his shop assistant is named Felice. Bernard Messenger, whom I'm glad Maureen introduced to you, will spare me the introduction, is a rather charming blind man and the son of Barry's new landlady. He has just separated from his wife in Bayside and moved all the way to Brooklyn and is now living in an upstairs apartment with among the messengers. The messengers live downstairs and Barry lives upstairs. They have a 13-year-old son, recently bar mitzvahed, and he is home with the mother. There is Uncle Nathan, Barry's mother's brother. There is Bob Donahue, who is Barry's rival, childhood friend, fellow optometrist, and Marilyn's lover. And then we'll find Enid Moscow, and you'll meet Enid herself. Enid is a physicist, a cousin of Barry's, and a fairly brainy woman. That's the group. Franny is Barry's sister, yes. And you'll hear about Franny more than Marie. So here we go. I'm terribly glad to be here tonight, by the way. I'm reading from chapter 7. Bernard Messenger has an impressive head of brilliantined black hair and a gaunt, handsome face disfigured only by the eyes themselves, opaque and sightless, the surrounding lids and skin bluish as if they had been bruised. For 8 weeks, passing November and December implacably in a preferred solitude, I have bundled against the damp chill of my room. I spent New Year's Eve after a solemn drink with Feliz in the back of the shop in an all-night movie theater on King's Highway. As the couple slowly left, a few solitary figures remained, slumped in the dark, and I slept through the arrival of the new year among the losers in the well-heated, snug movie house, the Dolby sound bellowing in my dreams, my bones warmer than they've been in weeks. Though I am attempting to complain to Mrs. Messenger that there isn't enough heat, my attempt is aborted by her blind son, who appears at the door similarly bundled against the resident chill. His mother, who usually receives me, is in bed with palpitations. He lets me in, and I arrive like a blast of cold weather, where he draws his sweater closer and belts it. He greets me effusively, and I realize how hopeless it is to stand and complain about the chill to Bernard. Oh, the dangers of pity I know well, but in the presence of a handsome, gaunt, blind man, I have few reserves of logic. Open on a green silk footstool is a book in Braille. When I ask Bernard what he is reading, he replies with some embarrassment, the Pensée of Blaise Pascal. A pause. Does that interest you, Mr. Glassman? Intently. Not only does it interest me, it takes my breath away. Whereupon his delight is audible, deep, satisfying sounds emanating like woodwinds. Immediately he seats himself in the easy chair before his book. The arms of the chair are worn, the soiled, matted stuffing showing through the shredded green silk. He reads with both hands, the fingers moving inward from the edges of the page. The heart has its reasons, which reason does not know. He tips his head up, his blind eyes groping somewhere to the right of me. I spent the morning on that sentence. Time is one of my luxuries. There's a connection, you know, between time and eternity. Have you ever thought of dying? The question appears to be thrown to some catcher behind me. Instinctively, I turn to be certain no one is there, glad not to be observed during this foolish interval. You don't need to answer. My questions are often greedy, I know. The heart has its reasons, he says. From inside, his mother's raspy voice calls out, Bernard, is that Norman? He turns in the direction of her voice. From the dining room, she suddenly appears, pink underpants over her loose, fleshy belly, a towel barely covering her naked breasts. No, it's the renter, Mr. Glassman, the blind son is saying, but it is too late. Her face is astonished. It seems to know everything. Silently, it registers that I am not Norman. She confronts me wordlessly, accusingly, as though her shame is my fault. No need to come in, Mother. It's just a friendly visit. He gropes again in my direction. Am I right? It's just a friendly visit. Oh, yes, I say, as the woman pulls the towel sharply across her pendulous breasts and vanishes. My voice is disheartened. I went to high school with a 5'2" sex maniac we called Storm and Norman. I merely wanted to say, if you ever need some help, you seem to be quite independent. A pause. The blind man's face is affable. Should your mother ever need anything while I'm upstairs, any kind of emergency, thank you. He extends his hand and holds it out perilously free until I walk over, take it in my own, and shake it up and down for a long moment. Then I leave. The image of Bernard's undressed mother asking if I were Norman, smoldering as she discovers her error, and Bernard's unexpected question about death, stay with me all day. A certain uncomfortable appetite for life was present in that room, running by its own laws in the face of sorrow and loss. In the shop at about noon, my sister Franny calls from San Diego. I'm glad to hear from her, but having to talk to her distresses me. For when I hear Franny's voice, nostalgia for family and the shock of Bernard's menage trespass on my nerves. I have indeed been underground. She hasn't heard from us in months. She couldn't fly in for the bar mitzvah because of Alan's car accident. He is just now out of his neck brace. She never had a thank you from Michael for the check. Was advised by Michael where to call. At first, hi, Aunt Franny, then a cool, Daddy doesn't live here anymore. Try the shop. What's going on, Bar? It's a long story, Franny, but I'll be all right. Have you and Marilyn split? Maybe. Gutting you, she says, injuring me beyond her realizing with that old Yiddish endearment our mother used to use. Mama used to say you two were her AT&T stock. Franny, that was only because your husband's cost her money. Her voice softens. What happened, she whispers. Oh, it's too long to go into. Is Michael in the house with Marilyn? He is. By his own choice? By his own choice. I can't believe it. He adores you, she mutters bitterly. They have school and Deirdre and the orthodontist. And you? I have a decent place in Brooklyn near the park, and I'm in the shop in 20 minutes, 25 tops. Are you depressed? Bar, I speak from experience. Someone asked me just this morning if I ever felt like dying. Bar, tell me the truth. No philosophical funny business. Are you eating? Are you able to get a night's sleep? Yeah, yeah, the worst is that Michael wants nothing to do with me. That keeps me up. The rest I'll get over. People do. The rest? Oh, let's not go into a Megillah on long distance. How are the girls? Is Karen getting along with Alan? Karen starts Santa Cruz in the fall. She avoids Alan. It broke her heart to send him a 75-cent get-well card while he was in traction. Frankly, I'll be glad when she leaves. Don't be so glad. Listen, Bar, I'm going to fly out to see you. You sound awful. Why did someone ask if you felt like dying? Who on earth asked you that? A doctor? Are you getting help? Barry, you're not suicidal, are you? No, I still get my reading done. Unhappiness is a moral state. I'm looking into it. What kind of question was that? Well, I have a blind neighbor, Bernard Messenger. He asked me. A blind messenger? How apocalyptic. I have to laugh. Actually, it was not a bad question. It amplified a certain moaning in me that I can now get rid of. I really don't plan to die. That's in you, she says again. I'll let you know what flight. Can you put me up? Sure, but it's one room. It'll be like old times on Kossuth Street. When I hang up, I notice that Felice has been listening. Felice is the shop assistant. In an hour, she calls back. Friday at 7 p.m., LaGuardia, TWA, flight 546. I reassure her that I go to work every day like clockwork. She tells me that what you do in a storm is lie low. Go get some lunch, I tell Feliz, but he is reluctant to go, as if he understands that while he is gone, I may decide to fire him. A cigar clamped between his teeth, he paces the length of the counter, and in a pretense of housekeeping, collects scraps of paper, clearing the dusty counter with one stiff hand edge as he aligns displays with the other. Then his muttering begins, a coil of words sliding frantically between his teeth. No time to breathe. Jesus God, not even time for a hot dog. Two sets of contacts all week, and both is due today. You never think of me, Barry. No one thinks of me. Bending his face, hiding from me the swelling ego that menaces in the hastening redness of his neck. He drags his shoes from bench to buffer, a lightweight in the world of runners, a heavyweight in my shop. I no longer know what is under his mask. He is as inscrutable as one of his Portuguese proverbs. 4 days until Franny arrives. Two of those days float by. I stay late in the shop doing inventory on contact lenses and accessories, placing an ad in the Times for a new optician, Benjamin, then abruptly changing my mind because I feel overwhelmed by Felice's predicament. I can see that were my life more even, Felice would be a less emotional assistant. I resolve to be more self-possessed. Keep my personal life to myself and retain police. He cries tears of thanks, which I despise, for they reduce both of us to actors. I can tell the blame is all in me, however. To Felice, the boss is part of a whimsical universe whose decisions confirm how accidental our fate is. The third night, having grown increasingly restless and sulky, irritated, in fact, by the unpredictable nature of Franny's impending visit to me, I set out to find Uncle Nathan and take him out for a meal. At the last minute, I decide to invite Bernard Messenger along for an outing. He is surprised, believes he has misunderstood, stands in the doorway, eyes staring beyond me into the night, hair black and polished, calling excitedly into his mother that he has an invitation to dinner. Will she be all right? Have her palpitations subsided? Yes, yes, it is an ordinary event. He is to go out with the renter. I phone ahead to alert Nathan of our coming. The blind man, bundled into winter coat and muffler, is seated next to me on the front seat of my car. In his hand, he carries his mobility stick, and although it is night, he is wearing dark glasses. There can be no question, he is unmistakably blind. In an animated voice, he asks where we are headed. This is clearly a festive occasion. I drive out along the park, and when we come to the first large intersection, I am mumbling about still being a stranger in Brooklyn. Are we now at Flatbush Avenue, he asks. I peer at the street signs, nod, and remembering, quickly say aloud, yes. All right, take a left here, go about half a mile until you come to a sprawling vegetable and fruit market on your right. Bay Produce, I believe. A Shell station will be on your left. Turn there. Bay Produce, an all-night market, looms on my right, a blaze of spotlights illuminating stands of eggplants, bananas, green peppers, and in the orange glow of a Shell station, and the orange glow of a Shell station clicks in on my left. I make my turn. All right, we're on Avenue U. Take Avenue U until McKinney's funeral parlor. Well lit, a blue sign. It's 5 or 6 minutes on the right, a low brick building with potted pines out in front. A little shabby. Traffic is slow. The corners of the windshield are dusting with snow flurries. The lights are against us, but within minutes, a small blue neon sign designating McKinney's funeral parlor is visible in the night. Spotlights, potted pines, and all. Hey, I say, you're cheating. He is roaring with laughter. Did you lose your sight recently? I was 8, he says. 8. The neighborhood changes very little, especially at the major intersections where the larger businesses are. My mother is the eyes and ears of the world. And until my father died last May, I used to go everywhere with him. We sold ladies' blouses. And Brooklyn was our territory. He noted all the changes on our routes. He took me through Brooklyn the way Virgil took Dante through hell. When you live with a blind person, if it's somebody you love and regard, you learn to talk about everything. My parents were talking machines. I sometimes think my father talked himself to death. They glossed everything they did. My mother still does. As I listen to Bernard, I feel a twinge of envy for a father who could so befriend a son, work side by side in search of the great American dream, the one describing and adoring, the other brilliant and blind and ambitious. And in the strictest privacy of my soul, I debate whether the blindness of a child is worth it, a question that embarrasses me. I loved my father, but my love did not extend to the mutual dependency of two men wrenching a single living from the world. And against my son's stupendous absence, I am fighting ferociously. For now, in our love's dilemma, I realize that our era, mine and Marilyn's, was that we didn't know how to love each other as much as we knew how to love Michael. To conceive only one child, to submit to nature in the guise of bum sperm, to be mocked by kids procreating everywhere like flounders, teenage pregnancies, young wastrels loping up and down 8th Avenue carrying their stuff in paper bags, their huge radios in their free hands, and snuggled into their scrotums thousands of monster sperm while their eyes lust after bigger radios and designer eyeglasses. To read about sperm banks and college students who produce eugenic sperm at will and sell it for profit, populating Boston, Atlanta, Salt Lake City, with unknown counterparts of themselves. And now to imagine Marilyn impregnated at last by Bob Donahue. Agnes took their 4 children to Hartford. How willingly she would spread her thighs, pump passionately against his velvet hardness, pray to her dead mother and father for one more child before her clock runs out, longing for a child from Donahue, and holding him and holding him and holding him as he comes deep, deep within her. And I weep to think that according to my best teaching and reading of the ethics, she is virtuous. To myself, I repeat that the desire of connection must be engendered not merely by external form, but by a love of begetting children and wisely educating them. Of course, Spinoza is speaking of marriage. But come on, Glassman, we all know this is the last of the 20th century. And for Michael, a half-brother or sister, could I deny him that? He would no longer feel the freak, an unmatched pea in the universe. And yes, she would educate her child. Marilyn would scrub floors, would immolate herself with kerosene, would walk to Jerusalem if she had to. And so, driving through Brooklyn's nighttime maze of avenues, guided by a blind man who becomes less and less blind as the journey continues, my faithless wife less and less faithless, I see, I understand. In my groin, I know her yearning and her need. Do I feel fingers poking at my thigh? Excuse me, you didn't answer. I said, aren't we close to your uncle's address? I squeeze my legs together and swerve them sharply away. The touch radiates through my groin and penis in waves of indignation. Yes, yes, I say, this is his block. I feel transparent, as if this blind man, who cannot see me, can see my confusion. But of course he has no idea that he has touched so close to my life. He was merely probing an unfatherly silence. I offered to take Bernard in, but he declines, preferring to wait in the car until we can head for the restaurant, one of Uncle Nathan's choosing. Uncle Nathan lives alone in the downstairs apartment of an ancient two-family house, which he owns. Anya, his Russian housekeeper, keeps the kitchen going, though the living room is a clutter of dead plants and plastic flowers wired into dry dirt. The carpeting is badly spotted. I have not been here in a year or two, but I look instinctively for the remembered photograph of Nathan standing with Leah, my mother, as children, arm in arm, in long bathing suits, in front of a sandcastle they had built beside the ocean in Asbury Park. There it is, still in its gray cardboard frame, on a mahogany end table with a wrought iron railing now fallen into rust. A pipe with ancient spittle dried on its stem leans next to it. I look into those faces in search of resemblances, and instantly I see Michael, more in the young Nathan than in Leah. I have a moment of alarm picturing Michael in 60 years, barrel-chested and crippled, but genes play sinister tricks. Michael himself could surely be mistaken for a son of Donahue's, his tendency to dimples, for example, and light eyes. I help Uncle Nathan with his jacket, but the trick string of genetics has me in knots as I wheel him out to the car, explaining to Bernard that my uncle is an invalid, and make the transfer from chair to back car seat. Uncle Nathan, a strong man with broad shoulders and a broad chest, is a great weight to move, and I doubt that my undergrown Michael will ever reach such an imposing physical presence. Uncle Nathan cracks jokes as he reaches in front to shake the hand of the blind dinner guest. He settles in. Wheelchair safely folded and stowed in the trunk, I am ready. Sweat trickling down my back from the exertion, my cargo of the infirm securely aboard. A more jovial group would be hard to imagine. So lighthearted is this outing, this unplanned, uncomplaining freight of the impaired. The activity is a tonic. Their need of me annihilates pity. The technique is to take each one in turn. Bernard waits at the curb, probing with his long metallic stick, dislodging a puff of snow as he smooths his careful black hair. I resettle Nathan, wheeling him near. Then we three enter together, the blind man, stick first, moving tentatively on the now slippery sidewalk, while I push Nathan just behind. We are in a Hungarian restaurant, bustling and noisy, tiled walls and old-fashioned oval mirrors glistening like cream. Nathan immediately stretches his head from his wheelchair to search the room, apparently for an empty table, one that can accommodate his chair without interfering with the flow of the waitresses, who are speaking Russian and Hungarian as they rush by. In a minute, his hand sweeps into the air. There she is, he says, immediately wheeling himself along, a waitress with dishes of food streaming on her forearm, saying, hi, Nathan, as he passes. He has taken off in the direction of my cousin, Enid Moscow, who sits alone at a table near the swinging door of the kitchen. Bernard is at attention, a bird motionless on a branch, readying himself to change logistics. I move to his elbow, and together we follow Nathan to Enid's table. Let me summarize my reactions to this trickery conceived by my uncle Nathan. One, only a very few men attain to a virtuous life through reason alone. Scriptures, revelation, allegories, and parables, all genres of masquerade and trickery, meet the needs of finite thinking beings. Two, the daily reality of religion in the life of the people was not overlooked by Baruch Spinoza, who had the common sense to evaluate Holy Writ or revelation very highly from the standpoint of its utility and necessity. Nathan approaches his death as a fellow of passion and holiness, for whom utility and necessity may mean, don't be chicken-livered, get her to the restaurant even if you have to lie through your teeth. Three, is Nathan pious or blasphemous? Judge a man only by his works and not by his opinions or protestations. Enid Moscow is blushing in embarrassment. She is as much a victim as I. Nathan, on the other hand, meows happily in his wheelchair, a big movie star pussycat, enjoying his canary. I could begin to feel happy myself, seeing the girlish, artless response of Enid Moscow seated next to me, her rumpled tweed sleeve brushing my arm, her eyes bright green through her badly tinted contact lenses. I could, and I do. Four, I do not desire Enid Moscow because she is good. She is good because I desire her. I sit next to her, and we say ordinary words about whether to have the veal paprikash or the stuffed cabbage. I know the veal will be very good, because I very much desire it. Chapter 8. Net gains after the Hungarian outing. Nathan has had a glorious time. Reveling in our company, his memory running back and forth over the events of his life like a typewriter ribbon. I discovered that at 15, he left the home my mother had provided for him because Liba Leah, in one of her phases, had become a Christian Scientist and would not allow him to use gentian violet on a badly scraped knee. It festered, and he was dragged screaming in pain by the observant mother of his friend Hesh to Montefiore Hospital to have it lanced. Fearing for his life with a woman who disdained gentian violet, Argyrol, eardrops, and other miracles of modern medicine, he took the money he had earned as a tailor's helper and sneaked away one night, boarding a train for Lexington, Kentucky. Gone for 2 years, he returned with his intuition intact, always trust a hunch you get before dinner, and enough cash to buy a Ford truck and deliver for a dry cleaning establishment. By 18, he was in his own business. By 20, he had his own apartment and a route in fashionable Prospect Park West, providing pickup service for the old guard there and in Brooklyn Heights around Remsen Street, contracting finally to do the pressing himself. As I leave him in his cluttered, dusty living room with its tasseled lampshades and cloisonné lilies, its smells of urine and lavender air freshener, he swears it was his intuition that drove him to call Cousin Enid to spend the night with family. Enid has been consoled by my presence. Since the deaths of her parents and the tragic disappearance of her brother, whom she adored, she's the only survivor of a once close and happy clan. I sense her fondness for me, a heedless kind of affection that one family member expresses for another. By the time we are having the apricot polizinta, I have told her about my work on the rainbow. Her interest delights my soul, though it is Bernard who immediately grasps my professional intent, who ignores the peripheral comment about the size and shape of the raindrops and cuts down to the essentials that would relieve people in polluted areas of eye infections and poor retention of lenses. Although she is quietly relaxing in her chair, attention is in its most natural condition. I can see that. At one point, she slips off her suit jacket, fishes out a piece of paper and a pen from her large leather bag, And to my excitement, draws a diagram of how the refracted ray is reflected twice and sometimes three times within a polluted drop of water. She draws meticulously, marking with artfully curved arrows each point of contact, carefully blackening in the head of each arrow. Then, for the benefit of Bernard, she explains aloud exactly what she has drawn, shakes her bristly brown hair off her forehead, and looks at me hopefully. I now remember her as the family brain, Bronx High School of Science, a PhD somewhere in Pennsylvania. She becomes voluble, tells me of her interest in Egyptology, how she plays tennis near the museum every Sunday morning at 8 with one of the curators. I tell her about the rainbow I witnessed the other morning over Prospect Park and how it pulsed into and out of view, finally vanishing in the early morning light. Bernard suggests I go down to the promenade in Brooklyn Heights. He speaks with the confidence of a zoologist who has spent a lifetime locating the natural habitat of a particular species of grasshopper. Seated between us, she is snapping with pleasure, overflowing the constraints of her slightly obsessive mannerisms. She straightens his plate, hands him her fork when his is misplaced, stretches a napkin over his tie. We gossip like old friends, staying so long that only a few diners remain. Many of the lights are out, and our shadows dance murkily on the tiled walls. She delights in taking charge, requests the bill of the waitress, makes the necessary calculations, and insists on splitting the cost with me. As she rummages for her wallet, the exertion produces a light sweat on her upper lip. Although Bernard and Nathan decline, she and I share a final glass of port the management brings as a gift. A vague stirring in my groin surprises me as brilliant cousin Enid submits to an unexpected request by Bernard. The present in which Bernard lives is a region of speculative blackness. He lives there theoretically and energetically, with an intellect so triumphant as to obscure his tragic affliction. He sits on the other side of cousin Enid as Russia itself sits on the other side of Europe. And I realize with envy that he has pulled her into his orbit, having more to say to her than I do. His conversation sparkles with anecdote and imagination. When he illuminates his ideas, a shock of daylight falls accurately onto the midnight. I have to remember he is a salesman. For all his intellect, he relies on whiff and gab. And though he is also a believer in the heart, his lucidity cuts sharper than an edge of glass. He elicits from her much that is autobiographical. She is a physicist for the Grumman Company, was married to a European physicist at NYU for 9 years until their marriage collapsed. Lutz Moskow by name, a specialist in semiconductors. No children, no regrets, suffers from lower back pain and from excessive tearing, I observe, as she continually dabs at her eyes with the tissue. Bernard, of course, seeing none of this. I fear that Bernard will approach her at the end of the dinner, ask for her number, and promise to phone. But so far, there is no, may I see you again? See her again. Instead, he says, forgive me, I must ask a favor of you. She is expectant. May I touch your face? I want to remember you. Enid falters, then presses his arm, her lips fluttering, and raises his hand to her cheek. She compulsively tucks a strand of stubborn hair behind her ear, then her hand falls away. The blind man is on his own. His long fingers move the sheath of her hair back from her brow. He traces each brow slowly and reverently, the curve of the nose, and with the tip of a finger, the clean circle of each nostril. He raises the other hand, and as he had done while reading from Pascal's Pensée, works both hands in from the edges, across the flushed hollow of cheeks, and back again to the small ears, running an index finger into the well of each ear, reading expertly this kind of braille, especially rapidly now, gently, sliding across and downward toward the prominent chin, dropping one hand and completing the search with the other for a lip, two lips, parting them, lightly tapping the small front teeth with a fingernail, slipping down into the cleft of chin, the underpath to the neck, the chest, and his hand stops, drops to find the other on the table, and clasps it. In the long silence, no one speaks. I have explored Enid's face as I have never seen Marilyn's. Enid's shoulders have risen and narrowed. In the end, she is perspiring and vulnerable. Once again, Bernard becomes a blind man, retreats into the obsessive darkness, tentative, insecure, sticks sweeping the way in front of him, dark glasses alerting the world to his condition. Just behind, I push Nathan in his wheelchair. On our way out, I say to Enid, "May I see you again? My sister Franny is coming for a visit. Why don't we do this again with her?" Bernard has paused, eyelids dropped, and I recognize the ardor of his listening, his slender figure and gaunt alertness, even a certain condescension, a slight hiss of attention escaping between his lips. On the way home, having safely installed Nathan in his house, just the two of us are on the front seat of the car. I dial some popular music on the radio. We listen in silence, backtracking over his former directions. As I escort him into his apartment, he pauses to thank me. "It was a wonderful evening," he says, and he encourages me to strike up a relationship with my cousin. "Avoid living alone," he says, "at any cost." Carefully, I refrain from suggesting that he do the same and place my slack hand in his.